We are living in uncertain times, and so it is more important than ever to be in charge of our financial futures. So for the next two episodes, we are going to be talking about money, specifically how, as women, we can be more independent with our finances, have open conversations about money, and support each other with knowledge and resources, develop a healthy mindset around money, and build wealth with confidence. I am so excited to be talking with Sharma Bunton today about building a values-driven relationship with money and spending and investing our money in places that align with the world we want to create and live in. Sharma's journey with wealth creation is a really interesting one when she realized, like many of us, that inheritance wasn't part of her future. So she went and learned about money management and built an extremely successful business and has achieved financial freedom and now is on a mission to help other women do the same. As the CEO and founder of Scaling Retail and the host of the Getting Rich Together podcast, Sharma is so passionate about empowering women to take control of their finances. And with over 25 private investments, her work as an entrepreneur, an advisor and board member of multiple organizations, she brings a wealth of knowledge and expertise and kindness to the table. And she runs these incredible live events in the United States where she brings women together with peer-to-peer mentoring so we can all learn from each other and improve our financial literacy and confidence. She speaks all over the country at South by Southwest, American Express, and her expertise has been featured in the New York Times, Forbes, many other places. Her message is, let's rewrite the rules of money together and create a world where every woman has the knowledge, resources, and confidence to achieve financial freedom. Oh, you are going to love what she has to say. So let's get the skinny from Sharma Bunton.
When was the last time you said, it has to be me? You know, that feeling where you know in your gut, this is what I want to do, and you just go for it. Welcome to It Has to Be Me. I'm Tess Masters, and I'm getting the skinny from people who are smashing their fears and doubts to go from dreaming to doing. Let's dive in, get fired up, and go after your next. It has to be me. If you want to get healthy and experience unprecedented energy and strength while eating delicious meals fit for you, join the March group of our 60-day reset. My dietitians and I will help you create a personalized plan to reach all of your health goals. We've helped thousands of people love their bodies at every age, and we want to help you. Join the next group at ithastobeme.com/reset.
Oh, Sharma, I am so excited to dive into your story and talk about money because we are just taught that it's a dirty thing to talk about. And I just love your approach. So one of the things that I love the most about your podcast is that you ask everybody about their money template that was formed when they were growing up. And yours is really fascinating. So can you take us inside how you were brought up as a child?
Yes. You know, it's so fun to go back into my story because, my gosh, it has certainly shaped my life, Tess.
Yeah.
You know, as a little girl growing up in San Francisco, I had two well-meaning parents, both Hare Krishnas. So both really in a heavily community-oriented religion.
Yeah.
They were both extremely dedicated to this religion. So when I was little, I have such distinct memories of being around a lot of community. And at the same time, they were both really dedicated to their practice. And so they were not working in some of these traditional jobs that a lot of my friends' families would work in. So my father ended up being a lifelong career taxi driver in San Francisco. And my mother being really, you know, God bless her soul. She's just one of those immigrant stories where it's like, I got to the country and then I went to school and, you know, really focused on education and work. But both of them together did the best that they could. Really, my mother driving home the importance of education. And so while my parents didn't have a lot of financial resources, my mother fought as hell to make sure that I was going to the best schools that I could get into. And she would just negotiate with these administrators on the tuition and, you know, get me into places that wow. I think I never would have been able to if she was not so determined for her child to have a better life than she did.
So where is your mom from?
My mom is from a little island off the east coast of Madagascar called Mauritius. And it's beautiful. It is just as beautiful as people think it is. She is one of nine siblings, and her siblings ended up living in so many places across the world, but yet she's the only one who ended up in the United States. And so it's really interesting because, you know, when I go back there, a lot of her siblings are there and I have cousins and the family is so big, but everyone's, all my cousins, all of our experiences, while we all come from the same lineage, are so different.
Yes.
You know, my cousins in France and my cousins in London, and here I am in California. We just could not be more different in so many ways.
Yeah. And so your mom moved to America and then she met your dad. Is he a Native American? I mean, I say Native American now. That's a completely different connotation. I don't know why I said that. That's ridiculous.
That's hilarious.
What's his ethnicity? That's a better way of saying it.
Totally. Well, you know, what's funny is my parents actually met in Mauritius, and my father had spent 10 years traveling around the world. And that definitely gave me quite a bit of courage in my life to do very similar yet different things. But my father met my mother in Mauritius and they got married there. And I do believe that they were pregnant. She was pregnant when they decided to come to San Francisco where he had been from. And so he was born in San Francisco, went to high school here. It's so funny to kind of have a lineage of being from this town. But certainly San Francisco looked a lot different back then than it does now. You know,
yeah.
I think it was demographically a lot more diverse in terms of, you know, the kinds of people and how you could have a life here. But coming to the United States, I don't know if that was ever really in my mother's vision of the world she had seen for herself, but she certainly saw the opportunity and did a lot to help herself. And that also was a lot of modeling for me as a young woman.
Yeah, wow. Well, love will make you cross the seas, won't it? So you talked about this focus on education and your mum bashing down doors, doing deals to put you into the best schools. So were you that kid at a private school where everybody else had all this money and you were on financial aid and stuff?
Well, you know, the schools that I went to were uniquely very small. And so when I say that, I mean, my graduating class of eighth grade had 12 students in it.
Oh, wow.
So this is very, very small. Our entire school maybe had, I don't know, 100 and something kids. And the school is now quite large and, you know, there's more children. But, you know, I definitely would see that my friends had, you know, parents that had more, you know, jobs in offices, you know, or some of them were in the art industry. And a girlfriend of mine, her father had, you know, one of the first phones in the car where, you know, you could call somebody. I mean, it was insane. And so I saw distinctly what other people's lives were. And what was really interesting for me and very confusing actually for me was, you know, my mother had this way of both wanting something but demonizing the thing she wanted. And so while, while she wanted wealth and wanted financial stability and wanted those things for herself, she simultaneously thought those people were bad. And so that was very confusing. And some of those characteristics, I think, are maybe not so uncommon, but as a young person, it was very confusing because I didn't know, are these the things I'm supposed to want or are these the things that I'm supposed to not want? And she raised me with a set of principles around study business, be financially successful, never depend on a man. My mother, I think, was very had a broken heart around, I think, what she thought her life would be like here. And so she wanted me to be more successful. And yet at the same time, I think she also thought that being success came with a whole set of negative consequences.
Ooh, so did this shape your impact-driven approach to financial freedom? Because it's very much centered around values.
Yeah. I mean, the stories around changing the world for me happened at a young age and were less centered around money and more centered around my determination and focus. And that would certainly serve me as I launched businesses and had careers. But the pivotal story and turning point of my young adult life or young life was when I was about 12 years old and I was writing letters to the White House. And I wanted to sing at the White House. I had been privileged to be a part of a choir. My mom was really focused. The schools I went to was focused on dance, theater, you know, was just really invested in me being this shiny human. And so I wrote letters to the White House for a year and I petitioned them to sing at the White House. And sooner than later, I was getting letters back from the social secretary. And all of a sudden, you know, I got a phone call when I was, 13 years old about the opportunity. Yeah. And I have to tell you, Tess, I blacked out sufficiently. So, you know, you get a call like that.
From the White House, I think I might faint.
I blacked out and I'm pretty sure my father took that phone call and but it was so remarkable because I found myself at the fall of my freshman year of high school on an airplane going to the White House, and it was the first time in my life that I had tears running down my face because I realized at that moment that not only did I have the opportunity in my life to change my life, but I could change the lives of the 25 other people around me.
Yes. So yeah. That was your first real, it has to be me. Yeah. I can have an impact. I can change things. I can make things happen.
Yes. It was so profound for me. And you know, I was that kid who wrote letters to my senator when I was 10 because I thought I should be able to vote because I thought adults were idiots. You know? So,
I love it.
So I was always outspoken and always very direct, but I didn't understand what it meant to really make the thought turn into the thing and then be able to see how that can not only change my own experience, but other people's experiences of themselves and what was possible in their own lives. And that is something I like to call a positive trauma. You know, you can't go back from that. Once that happens, that happens, you know, it doesn't leave your psyche.
It just becomes part of your cellular being. Like you take it, you carry it with you. Yeah. Yeah. So how did you run with that? That feeling of I can change the world, I can make stuff happen. Like, take me into the next, it has to be me.
Oh my gosh. I mean, my next moment was actually some years later when I probably had the most existential moment of my life.
Take me inside of that.
And it was a psychedelic existential moment.
Oh, well, we've all had those. Yeah.
And I was 16 years old and Whoa. I was sitting in a park with some girlfriends and I closed my eyes and I had this vision of my body in the cosmos and I could see my clothes being stripped away, my skin, the muscles, the skeleton. And I had this profound sense of oneness with the world around me, again, at this very young age. And that particular moment, what really stuck with me was the infiniteness of what I was capable of, right? This ability of it really can be anything, right? The energy of the world. And so, as you can tell, my mind, I've always been a deep philosopher. And, you know, I'm like the young kid that most adults are like, please stop talking. Like, you're too smart for your age, and I really don't want to hear it from you.
I kind of want to know who you wrote to next after that. It has to be me.
That was, you know, it changed the way that I looked at approaching opportunities. And so from that moment, if I wanted a job, if I wanted to do something, I knew that all I had to do was decide. You know, what I found was that having the things I wanted were not, it wasn't the problem. The trouble that I would have in my life would be choosing.
Ooh. So what was your barometer for choosing? If you knew this reality, what was it? What were your full-bodied yeses and full-bodied noes?
Oh, you're going to die. So I was in university in San Francisco and I was dating someone for, I don't know, a hot second, and was like, I'm going to go to New York and see one of my girlfriends, and went to New York. Was supposed to be there for 3 weeks and ended up calling my then boyfriend and saying, I'm going to move here now. And it was like, boom, like universe was like, you don't have any money and you don't know how you're going to make it, but you need to be here. And so I ended up staying, and it was like, I didn't know what I was doing, but yet I knew exactly what I was doing.
Yes, I know exactly that feeling, or at least what it feels like in my body.
Yes.
Absolutely. So you went with your gut, you stayed in New York.
I stayed in New York. I ended up, you know, it would be no surprise, ended up getting my degree in economics and philosophy. So I was just obsessed with how does the world work, and, you know, how does everything come together? And found myself in a career in fashion. And I had known at a young age of about 25-ish that I wanted to be my own business owner, and I wanted to be an entrepreneur. And it was very visceral. I was always very focused also on self-development. So I had taken a course at about 24, 25, very similar to some folks might recall Landmark, right? Personal development, yeah. Like, who are you? And yeah, I'm a young kid, but I'm like really focused on like just seeing how big this life can be. And so I remember distinctly writing down, you know, I am going to own this business. I want to have this consultancy, and I know I'm not ready yet. And so I had a very clear download of what do I need to do? And I said, well, if I'm going to launch a successful practice, I need to have the experience, the brands, and I need to be able to really package myself. And so I kind of reverse engineered what I would need to make that jump by then curating the next steps of my professional career. And there's a lot of thinking around that, but there were moments, I'm telling you, Tess, where I was, you know, so dead set on getting this next promotion or making these leaps that I had friends who said, why are you trying so hard? And I'm saying, well, this is not the end goal. These are the steps that I need to take to get to this thing I want. And no one had given me this playbook, but the universe was like, these are the things you need to do. And I just was sort of, again, following down a road and not quite sure where it would end up, but yet very well knowing how it would end up.
Yeah. So how did it end up?
So I had this amazing career in fashion. I worked at Barney's. I was, you know, a buyer at Gucci, like just really had an incredible experience. But certainly in New York, it's expensive there. And while I worked at these really incredible luxury houses, I didn't get paid very much. And, you know, a lot of my money went towards surviving, honestly,
yeah.
You know, and hopefully getting invited to great parties where they had good food, because, you know, it's expensive to eat out.
Sorry, the quintessential New York response.
It's so true. Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
And those are the priorities, right? It's like, yeah. How do I make this work? And it was from 2012-ish. So I had this great fun career in New York. And I noticed distinctly that the people who were ahead of me in these organizations were deeply unhappy. And I had some of my very first aha's that, you know, if I was going to be a leader of an organization, if I was going to progress in a career path, I didn't want to live a life like these people. And so I was learning a lot by other people's unhappiness.
Oh gosh, that's big.
Yeah.
What was the it does not have to be me moment for you where you got out of that world?
Oh my God. It was seeing at the time, it was, you know, some of the VPs in the organization, they would be there like me until 10 o'clock at night, but they were about 10 years, 15 years my senior.
Yeah.
And while I knew as a young kid that, like, you know, you put in the time and, you know, my work ethic was strong, when I looked down the road and I saw that they were still putting in the time, that they did not have significant others, that they were unable to hold on to relationships because they had over-indexed into the vanity of the organization, that their identity was caught up in the job. And mm-hmm. I knew that for me, like, there were moments, Tess, when I would meet people, I wouldn't tell them where I worked because I didn't want the association of who they think you must be. Yes. When you say you work at a company like a Gucci, right?
Yes.
And I didn't want to be judged on that because people are like that, unfortunately. And so I knew by seeing my seniors above me what it was I did not want. And it didn't take me long to realize that I needed to do something different. I needed to do it on my own. And that was a big moment. It was 2012. I had met my then husband, and he was living in Los Angeles. And I was like, you know, I've got the pedigree now of the organizations I need to work at. And I feel pretty confident in my skill set. I've built a business from $50 to $100 million. Like, I am good. I can do this. I had the confidence in myself. And so I set up shop in Los Angeles with my first company, Scaling Retail. And I got to tell you, it was one of those moments where everyone was like, what are you doing? You know, like, you could go on to have a much bigger career. What are you doing? And I was like, I have to do this. You know, this is the next step in my life. And I've proceeded to have this company now for the last 12 years amongst other businesses and ventures and things. But it was really my very first step in saying, okay, it is now up to me and the path that is being downloaded in front of me.
So tell me about how, while you were working with those people and building out your team, how did that shift things for you in terms of your approach and how you were fine-tuning this template that you were creating and this company culture that you were creating?
Yeah. I mean, there was some trial and error test. You know, I think for me, one of the most challenging things was actually learning that I wasn't building a family. You know, I
Ooh,
think.
Tell yeah. me more about that. Oh, gosh, that's such an important distinction. I love this. Take me inside of that.
Well, you know, I think that in the beginning, you've had this idea that, you know, I'm going to choose all these people and we're going to be together and, like, and we all want the same things. And even I was really aware of the fact that not everyone was going to stick around forever. I still thought naively that, you know, we were all going to put in the effort and the time and we all saw what was urgent, right? But truly at the end of the day, what was urgent for me was not necessarily urgent for everyone else. And I even tried to instill something that I think is still quite successful, which is this idea of what is stressful and what is urgent. You know, I really tried to instill this idea that stress is something you can access in really specific, important moments. And we shouldn't shy away from stress, but we need to use it in very deliberate ways to help us achieve specific things for short periods of time. But I also really believed in urgency, right? So it's not, it's not about not operating efficiently. It's about operating with the sense of priorities. And so there's a delicate balance there when it comes to the efficiency and urgency versus what constitutes stress. You know, I also believe that stress would be things that other people would impose on you versus urgency could be really a set of your own priorities, you know, and how you want to approach things. So I've tried lots of different things, Tess, when it comes to how to think about, you know, getting people to feel confident, connected, and see the vision while maintaining a sense of self-integrity. And I think when you look at it from that lens, it puts you as a business owner in a position where you do not want to be exploitive. And sometimes that actually means you don't run as fast as you want, because the people around you, right, you want them to have a balanced life and, you know, these things that are so important. But it means you need to sometimes take it a little slower. So certainly things have been challenging for me.
Yeah. The other piece of it too is that integrity is this concept, and we all have this broad strokes idea of what that means. But when we put it inside our bodies and our template for what is right and wrong or appropriate or doable, then integrity becomes something that can be interpreted a lot of different ways. So when you're leading an organization and you have a particular ethos and a way that you want your company to be represented, everybody's going to have a different path to stepping in line with that. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's one of those things that I should also say is, you know, I was building my business, you know, in a new marriage, and, you know, we may or may not get to this in various capacities, but you know, that marriage ended up ending, which was a huge pivotal moment for me. And what I'd realized that in the course of building my business through my unhappiness and my dissatisfaction with my personal life, I over-indexed my own identity into my work. And so by virtue of
tell me a bit more about how you did that. Because I totally want to get into it, if that's okay with you.
Yeah,
because
of course.
I think it's such a common story as older women and women of any age. You know, when relationships break down and marriages break down, it changes you, you know, in varying ways. So I'm interested in how the breakdown happened for you and then how it changed you.
Yeah. So when it comes to the breakdown, you know, both my ex-husband and I, we lived fairly independent but together lives. And it's very typical of, I would say, a lot of New Yorker relationships, right? Like you each do your own thing, you get, you know, it's like very independent. And I had taken a lot of that and a lot of my mother's conditioning of, you need to make your own money, you need to do it yourself if it's going to happen. And so in this new business, he and I were both busy, you know, with our own respective lives. And the busyness, which I thought was a lane of independence, actually ended up being a very big, great divider for us. And so because we were traveling at different times and different places and different countries, when he wasn't there, I found myself, well, what am I going to do? I'm just going to work more. And so I would double down on the areas of my life that I found the most success in. And there was one thing that I always knew to be true in my life, which is I know how to build business. I know how to make money. So that is what ended up taking most of my time and attention. And when we would come back together, it was like roommates in a house, right? Like we were trying to be together, but we were living very separate lives.
Oh, Sharma, I feel like you are explaining what happened in my life in a previous relationship. It's very, very similar. And a lot of my friends have very similar stories too. So dear listener, you may be nodding your head going, that happened to me as well, right? I mean, it's, you know, we're certainly not alone in that. So take me into the next It Has to Be Me, where the marriage ended and you had to rejig your financial life.
Oh, so I have to tell you, Tess, the moment it ended, the moment was in a car on the way to Ojai for a women's retreat.
Oh, I love Ojai. It's like my spirit place. I mean, please. Amazing. Yeah, totally.
And the words came out of my mouth, you know, he asked me a question and but I was like, the words that came out of my mouth specifically were when I'm happy. And it was, and I couldn't not, I could not unsay it. It was basically like everything that I had felt was coming out. And in fact, that evening that he, you know, he dropped me off at this retreat, and then literally that would have been the night before, that would have been the last time we were in the same house together. And it was a, again, full body knowingness in my body that this was it. And I did not know, didn't know what was going to happen next. I had no idea what was ahead of me, but I knew I was doing the right thing.
Yeah.
And I was convicted. You know, I know that some people ask me early in the process, well, do you have doubts? Are you confused? No, like it was very, very clear to me that this was the thing I needed to do. And following that came all of the freakouts that one would think. You know, I had hired someone to help make me some meals. I had hired somebody to sort of help me think about money. But all of a sudden, I realized that I needed help and that I wasn't going to be able to do this alone. And that, to me, I think was one of the most pivotal moments, was saying, for the first time in my life, I'm not going to muscle through this. I am actually going to seek and get support. And I had never done that before in my whole life. It was wild.
Yeah. Yeah. So how did that change your approach moving forward? Like, yeah, this new way of expressing yourself, of connecting with others, of meeting the moment.
I mean, Tess, there is something so incredible that happens when you tell everyone you're getting a divorce and people tell you they had no idea how unhappy you were.
Yeah.
You know, it was the moment where I realized that I had done such a good job of hiding my own sadness, even from myself, you know, yes, and from the people closest to me. And so as I was starting to figure out what life would look like, I sent out an email to 50 girlfriends and I asked them if they would talk to me about money. You know,
how did that go? I'm fascinated by this.
Yeah, well, you know, I realized that in the spirit of vulnerability and openness that I was now on this journey of, I'm not going to pretend to know anything that I don't know. I need help, right? I need to talk to people. And so I sent this email out and 95% of the women did not want to talk to me about money. And
these were friends of yours.
These were friends of mine.
Yeah. Wow.
These were friends of mine. And it wasn't that I was asking them for financial advice and they couldn't give it. It was that I wanted to talk about just how they managed money, how they, like, what were they thinking about it? Like, what are the things I need to be doing? Like, how do I think about my life now? And I had a few friends who wanted to refer me to their wealth managers, but also did not really know what was going on with money. And then I had three girlfriends who raised their hand and said, Shama, I want to learn about this with you. And
really?
Yes. And the most incredible thing happened, which was I realized both that just like our sexuality and our relationship to our body, money is one of those things that you will never depart this planet of without having a relationship to. Like, you will have a relationship to food, to your body, to money, to, I mean, everyone has a relationship. And so I realized in that moment that the 95% of women who didn't want to talk to me, that there was a problem and that I needed to be able to create the space to be able to have these conversations.
Oh, so you were using the relationship with money as a portal to self-actualization.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, I love this. Okay, because I use the relationship with food as the portal into understanding why we do what we do. I love this. Okay, so what'd you learn?
Oh my God. So Tess, I did all the good things. I did all the things a good girl does. You know, I took all the classes. I took the VC courses at Columbia. I joined Angel Syndicates. I took all these webinars. I basically was like, okay, I need to learn and figure out all these things. And I learned so many things. I learned that women didn't want to talk about successes because they didn't want other women to feel bad. I learned that women also didn't want to talk about their failures because they didn't want to look bad. So I started talking about all those things. I started raising my hands in the communities and the spaces that I belong to. And I would say, where are the wealth expanders in this room? Who can talk to me about their experience?
Tell me, give me a your definition of a wealth expander.
Yeah. So for me, a wealth expander is someone who's willing to share with me their relationship and their journey to money in their life. The expansion piece of it has to do with me being able to see and relate to things so that I might be able to say, oh, that's interesting and I want to pursue that, or, you know, that doesn't land with me and that's not for me right now. So it can be in so many ways, right? There are expanders in so many aspects of our life, but I needed to see what was possible and I needed to be able to hear other people's journeys so I could start to figure out what my own journey could look like. Mm.
And as you were learning this for yourself and interacting with all of these other women, take me into the next It Has to Be Me, where you started helping other women empower themselves and reach financial freedom, and at the same time have a relationship with money that was in alignment with their values.
Absolutely. So for me, a big piece of it was as I started to lead conversations, people wanted to know, who were the people they should be talking to? You know, what were the resources that they needed? And who were the recommendations? And what I realized early was I have no desire to be a financial advisor. You know, my goal here is not to manage a portfolio. I actually find myself playing a very critical role as matchmaker and host, which is which is bringing groups of women together to facilitate the conversation so that they can actually unlock from each other, right? Because often we are wisdom keepers and we do not recognize the wisdom that we have, and we don't often honor what we have figured out. So a big component of this is unlocking through peer-to-peer matchmaking. You're learning this. I want to learn about this. I have experience in this, and how you can help women connect to unlock with each other in their financial journeys. The other component is obviously finding the right people to be able to create safe spaces for women to have conversations that they really haven't had an opportunity to have before. You know, it's terrifying to us when I think about how women are inheriting, you know, $30 trillion in the next 5 years, and yet only 28% of them feel confident investing their money. It scares me because I believe that if we do not feel more confident with how we leverage our resources, we actually won't be able to create the vision of the world we want to see. We won't be able to actually invest in the people, the businesses, and ideas that are going to be around for our children's children, right? So there's almost a responsibility to take ownership over this in our lifetime.
Yeah. So how do you gain confidence? How do you do that? You know, how do you decide where you invest your money?
You know, there are three key components that I think are really critical. I think the first is being able to have access to a great community. You know, I think that there is the moment you put any person, but let alone a woman, in a room where someone else is the expert, there's a real tendency to want to undermine what we know or to not ask the questions, right? So community learning is actually really advantageous when you're starting to poke around and learn things, because you want to be seen and you want to be on the same page. The second component to that is obviously access to the right education. There are too many financial conversations that are happening that treat women like children. you know, feel better about the stock market, you know, the economy will rebound, you know, like, it's, you know, don't invest, be a philanthropist, like use your money to donate, you know, why you don't belong in this world of investing. I literally had a friend tell me the other day, her wealth manager told her, why would you take this money out to invest anywhere else? It's doing so well here. Right. So simply not engaging. Right. So the educational component of the right information is important. And then the last thing that I think is just so critical is access to great opportunities. And that means the person who's going to tell you, oh, you should take a look at this stock or this investment vehicle. You know, you should take a look at, listen to this woman's webinar who's talking about real estate investing. We need to have access to the right opportunities, because what happens is, we get access to so many opportunities. Thank you, YouTube and all the other platforms that serve us information. But what will happen with most women is we will make an investment into something, and if it doesn't go well, we get burned and we feel shame and guilt and we don't want to do it again. And so we need to be able to not only repeat and flex those muscles over time, but we need to have a sense of trust with the people who are getting these opportunities from.
And so, going back to this first bit of it, which is finding this community where you can build that trust, start experimenting with building your confidence by speaking to people that you connect with, where you're getting the full-bodied, yes, yeah, these are my people. I'll dip my toe and invest a tiny bit in this. What do you recommend in your community in terms of figuring out what is right? Is it investing in causes you believe in companies you believe in? Like, where should we start? Like, let's say I've never invested my money anywhere and I've been keeping it, you know, in under my mattress or in the bank and I've kind of never done it before. Where do you recommend that we start in terms of deciding what the right opportunities are?
Yeah, you know, so the community that I manage, the Catalyst community, a big part of it is understanding your own values. You know, there's obviously the baseline, you know, and a lot of the conversations I have are not about, you know, cutting your lattes to save for a rainy day. You know, I think that there's plenty of people out there who sort of focus on the basics, and having the basics covered, meaning whatever that looks like to you, which is also very personal, really needs to be addressed before you start to take incremental risk, right? You know, I have a lovely woman who's speaking at my summit who follows the financial independence retire early model, you know, which is amazing for some. It's the idea that, you know, I now have so much that I have saved, and that's actually making money from my dividends, that I don't have to work as hard or work at all, and I can live off of that. But other women might say, you know, that feels really restrictive. I actually want to keep building my wealth more actively. And so this idea that there's one size fits all is something we really need to throw out the window. The idea that a wealth manager is going to solve all your problems by putting together a plan is just not the case. And so the very first thing, once I think the basics are covered of your lifestyle and your living, is to ask yourself, what is important to me and where do I want to see my impact in the world? And what's so interesting, Tess, is that can happen in much more high risky assets. Like, I'm going to invest in a climate venture capital fund, or it can be in less risky assets, which I'm actually going to invest in the stock market in an ETF that is focused on climate friendly businesses. And so there's a range of risk that we can really take into consideration when we look at how we create impact. High impact doesn't have to be high risk, but it takes a great amount of thoughtfulness to be able to realize that my money actually matters. And it matters not only to myself and my family, but me being consciously active with it can actually impact the world.
Yeah, and there is this tendency, particularly in today's society with the ascension of these, you know, Bitcoin billionaires and, you know, millionaire influencers and YouTube and Instagram personalities, that we really glamorize high risk, you know, and this kind of, there's something about that, right? So, how do you combat that? phenomenon that is just in our faces every time we pick up our phones.
You know, what's so funny about that question, or fun, is, you know, on my podcast, Getting Rich Together, I intentionally highlight the stories of women from so many different backgrounds, and some of them whose investing lives are rather normal and they're really happy and their life is great. And some of them who are high risk and doing all these big things. But the real goal of this show is to show women that you are not ahead, you're not behind, you are right where you need to be. And again, when we're being fed this barrage of Instagram influencer fame, which ultimately without values ends up in, you know, depression, addiction, and so many things that end up derailing whatever those assets could have done for you, right? So certainly could change your life, but also in a good way and a bad way. I think what's so valuable and important is to realize, you know, what does a good life look like for me? You know, and what have my money stories programmed me to think is a good life versus what I know my good life is?
Yeah, I love that. When this summit that you've got coming up and these events and this community that you've built, how can we be a part of it? Like for dear listener, you're listening and thinking, Sharma's just yummy, and she is.
No secrets here, Tess. There are no secrets.
Right? How can we be a part of it?
You know, there are two summits we have coming up that are life-changing because they've not only never been done before, but in this way, I think are so magical. So they are the Women in Wealth Catalyst Summits. The first one is March 27th at the Golden Gate Club in San Francisco, intentionally set in a historic national park with beautiful views of the Golden Gate Bridge. I wanted the women to attend, to drive into a beautiful, abundant space where they can be in nature and fresh air and see the sky and feel the potentiality. And then the second will be May 13th in New York City, hosted by MasterCard at their Innovation Tech Center. And the registration for that is at women.win. And what I think is
That's a great website. Oh my goodness.
I did good on that one. That was good. score one.
Totally.
But what I think is so unique about this test is the day promises to be two really unique things. The first is there are no celebrities. This isn't hearing from someone who's been on Shark Tank how they did it 30 years ago. These are real women. These are women who are getting on stages in panel conversations, no keynotes, no one's better than anyone else. And we're actually having honest conversations about the creative ways in which we've thought about this. You know, the woman who's built a real estate portfolio that now throws off cash where she can afford to start other businesses, you know, and the woman who's investing in land, or the woman who's talking about her exits where they did not give her the generational wealth that most people think entrepreneurship exits should give you. You know, there are so many ways in which we are popping the bubbles here on the glamorization and the hypiness of what we think success is today, to be able to provide women a safe space to be able to say, okay, but what about this? How do I think about this? And oh, let me learn. So very unique format, ranging everything from high risk asset classes like venture capital to even looking at how you manage your own stock portfolio. Because Tess, I know millionaires who manage their own stock portfolio.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
So do I.
And yep. They're not, you know, working with these other managers. They're saving that 1%. And guess what? It's a big deal. A 1% could be a big deal.
One of the wealthiest guys I know in New York City manages his own portfolio. Yeah.
And it doesn't have to be crazy. Like,
yes,
people can do this if you want to. And so that to me is a big component. And then the second thing is that is so unique is this idea of peer-to-peer matchmaking. And us with our application process, I have the ability to say, you know, Tess, you've really figured this out. And, you know, Shama's really figured this out. And you guys can really learn from each other. And you don't have to show up to this conference without knowing anybody. You will know
people. Because it's intimidating when you walk in the room and you think everybody knows everybody else. And, oh, I just get paralyzed. Like, I'm quite socially awkward in those situations. It's awful. Nobody wants to talk to me. Oh, my goodness. They're going to be looking over my shoulder. It's just, oh, my goodness. So if you are not able to be in San Francisco or in New York, is listening to the podcast the best way that someone living in Italy or Australia or wherever can connect with you and hear more about your philosophy about this? Because it's yes. so good.
Oh, thank you, Tess. You know, the podcast Getting Rich Together is the number one place to go to feel seen and to be heard and to be engaged in the conversation. You know, our Catalyst community is the second way to do that. And, you know, that is an incredible space to get the education and the access to the opportunities. And so I would say, please come find me, but most importantly, come find your people so that you can get rich together with everyone else.
Yeah. Oh, I love this. Yes. Let's get rich together. Oh, my goodness. Because you can help so many more people and do so many more things, right? I mean, money doesn't make you happy. But gosh, you got more choices, that's for sure.
For sure.
Tell me about what life looks like for you now that you've remarried and you're a stepmother yes. to these beautiful three kids. And oh my goodness, it's just a completely different life. So what does yes. that balance look like for you now? This happiness that you have now that eluded you before?
You know, once again, the universe sent me an incredible download. You know, I was at that phase where I was not in the process of looking cute for anyone else, but for myself. And was part of an entrepreneurial organization and met my now husband at one of the business conferences. And Tess, we eloped 10 weeks later in Venice, Italy. I went from never having any children to being a stepmom to three beautiful boys. I never could have imagined that my life would unfold in this way. And yet when everyone else was saying, again, what are you doing? I was like, this is right. Like, this is what is right for me. So another moment of just going for things that really don't make any sense to anyone else. But my life now
they don't have to.
No, it doesn't.
They don't have to.
It doesn't.
Your it has to be me only needs to make sense to you. Right?
That is correct. That is right? correct. Yes. Thank
and
you
no
for that.
And no qualifiers and nothing else needs to happen. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
That's true. That's true. So life is abundant in lots of different ways. I now get to be in a relationship with someone where we can ideate and think about the world in the most dreamy, philosophical ways that I've been doing my whole life on my own. You know, I'm with someone who puts my happiness as like a high priority, and I get to feel and hold and accept that love and also come to terms with that love in ways where I realized the deficit of that in my life before, right? Yes. Your own triggers, your own things come up and you go, wow, like I didn't know that love could be like this. And so there's a relaxing, there's a little girl inside of me that is, at first it was like, is this real? That has been relaxed into a family life where I get yeah. to be held and cared for and loved, not because of awards that I've won or not because of, you know, hitting these goals and doing all these big flashy things, but just because of who I am. And that is a peace and a love and a joy that I didn't know was possible for me.
Oh, well, that's beautiful. And I mean, you know, that's the goal, isn't it? It's the dream. When you say for who I am, what does that mean for you?
You know, in our vows with my husband, we said we promised to love each other for all that we had been, all that we are, and all that we will be. And so loving me for who I am is loving me for the expansiveness of the fact that I will not be the same person in 2 years. And it's a love of the process of my own expansion because who I am at my core is love, but my exterior and all the layers underneath are so touched by the human experience that things will change. And so there's a commitment to the process of loving rather than a commitment to the staticness of the moment in time that we met each other.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And I want to come full circle to how you now get to impact these three boys and their money template at this really pivotal time in their lives.
You know, what's so powerful, and I don't think a lot of people talk about the benefits of being a stepmother. So I'd love, you know, I feel like there needs to be some other podcasts where we talk about, like, you know, how awesome it is to be a stepmom and what privilege it can be and how rewarding it can be. And one of the things that I feel is a duty, again, coming out of myself and the universe, so no one's told me this, is to instill critical thinking into the children. And it's an easier role for me to do because of the time in their lives that I've come into their life. And so for me, a big part of their own understanding of the world, which translates into understanding of money, is to be able to understand what's right for them and not what is right for other people or what their parents necessarily think they should believe in. And so when our middle son, who is the more people-pleasing person, you know, I'll say that I like something and he'll say, I like that too. And I said, well, why? Like, can you help me understand what about it you like? It's great if we like the same thing, but I'd love to know more about why you like it. And that is, I think, a fundamental component in developing a healthy relationship to then, I have money. What am I going to spend my money on? How do I sort of look at saving it or not? Not based on what are people telling me, but also like, let me think about what feels right for me, you know, and let me think about what I think I want to do with this money. You know, I know I have some friends who are really strict, you know, you have money, don't spend it, put it here. And it's very controlling. And I think that there's benefit obviously in teaching a saver's mindset. But I think that when you are so harsh in certain ways, you suffer the risk of backlash and you suffer the risk of resentment. And so for me, what I always wish I was empowered with was a sense of critical thinking about my life. And that is what I hope to impart with them.
Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, I can't wait to see how that develops. That's very, very, I mean, it's very, very exciting. It's
very
so
juicy.
Exciting. Juicy is the word, and I love everything juicy. So, oh gosh, I cannot wait to talk to you further about that. So I always close every episode with the same question, which is for someone who has a dream in their heart and doesn't feel like they have what it takes to make it happen, what would you say to them?
Get quiet and listen deeply to what it is you know to be true. You know, I think that there is the lack of confidence or fear usually comes from other people's voices. It doesn't come from your own voice. It comes from someone else, somewhere else. And there's a part of us inside that always has the knowing. You know, the thing I like to tell a lot of my girlfriends, especially when they go through a tough breakup or something that's challenging and they don't know what's going to happen, is remember the moment that you self-betrayed in that relationship. It was the moment when you stopped listening. And so if we can get back to listening, we then make incremental decisions based on our own integrity. And the timelines might look different. They may not look like your friends. But the path to your own happiness lies in listening deeply.
I feel like a plant that's been watered. Oh, gosh. Dear listener, Sharma really is as delicious as she seems. So definitely go over to the Getting Rich Together podcast. It's so, so wonderful. And I really love how you meet each guest in this place of integrity and listening. So thank you so much for this beautiful conversation.
Thank you, Tess. You are a dream.
What a beautiful conversation. So many great takeaways. What is your money template? What are the beliefs around money that were instilled in you as a child? And is that money template serving you to create the life that you want? I loved when she said, what does a good life look like for you? What has your money template and money stories programmed you to think is a good life versus what you know your good life to be? I love the impact-driven approach to financial freedom, where everything that we do with money is centered around our values. Asking yourself, what is important to me? Where do I want to see an impact? And that high impact doesn't necessarily have to be high risk. The idea that my money matters, not only to myself and my family, but how it can impact the world. When she said, with your finances, you're not ahead and you're not behind, you're exactly where you need to be to learn the lessons, have the experiences, and take the next step. It was interesting what she was saying about 95% of women don't want to talk about money and the importance of having those wealth expanders in our lives. You know, someone who's willing to share their relationship and journey with money so they can help us figure it out, figure out what our journey looks like, and that we can be wealth expanders for other people. And that owning your wisdom and experience and sharing it has value. That we are wisdom keepers, and often we don't recognize the wisdom that we have. And the way that we unlock wisdom is through peer-to-peer matchmaking and mentoring, which is what she's doing with her events. I loved when she said, when you put any person in a room where someone else is the expert, there's a tendency to undermine what we know and not ask questions. That really resonated with me. And the importance of finding community, so that we have the knowledge, the resources, and the confidence to make financial decisions that align with our values and the lives that we want. And she said that women will inherit $30 trillion in the next 5 years, and yet only 28% of them feel confident investing that money. And that if we don't feel confident with how we leverage our resources, we can't create the world that we want to see. And you won't be able to invest in the right people, the businesses, and the ideas that are in alignment with that vision. Oh, I feel like putting that on a bumper sticker. And how do you decide where to invest your money? I liked her three pillars: access to great community, access to the right education about money, that a lot of financial conversations treat women like children. So finding that education where women are going to be empowered and having access to great opportunities. In addition to all of this great information about finances, I really appreciated some of the general takeaways. When she said, I changed the way that I looked at opportunities, where she realized if I want something, I knew that all I had to do was decide that I was going to do it. And having the things that I wanted wasn't the problem. It was choosing what I wanted. That really struck a chord with me because I think I'm the same way. So I'd be interested to hear what you think. And what she was saying about the fear about making decisions, about just getting quiet and listening deeply to what you know to be true, that fear usually comes from other people's voices. And there's a part of us that always has the knowing. And when she said, what are you over-indexing in your life? You know, she gave the example of being in the fashion world, you know, and high finance, you know, where there was the vanity and the identity being solely tied up in work. But it made me think about the things that I'm over-indexing in my life. So yeah, it was a great thing to think about. And that idea of that your life only needs to make sense to you, that your it has to be me, doesn't need any qualifiers. Nothing else needs to happen. You don't need any other permission but your own to go after your it has to be me. And when she said, the moment you self-betray is when you stop listening to yourself and what you need. Ugh, I really, really loved that. So definitely check out Sharma's podcast, the Getting Rich Together podcast, her Women and Wealth Catalyst Summits coming up in San Francisco and New York, and just join her community and enter her world on social media. Oh, she is every bit as beautiful and fabulous as she seemed on this podcast. So definitely leave a review. I would love to hear what you think, and share with me in the Facebook group what resonated with you from this episode.
I want to hear about your It Has To Be Me story. So head on over to ithastobeme.com/stories to share it in our free community. You can also join the conversations we're having about this episode and others. I'm Tess Masters. Join me next week and we'll dive inside another great story to help us go from dreaming to doing.